Welcome to the podcast of Hemisphere, the official journal of the European Hematology Association. Hemisphere's podcast presents insightful, expert discussions about recent hematology publications. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles DeBock, and I'm a group leader here at the Children's Cancer Institute in Sydney, Australia, and one of the scientific editors for Hemisphere. So in our last episode, we were talking with Petya and Jörg, who are two of the three authors on a recent review article on metabolism and hematology. It turns out, though, that we had a lot more to talk about than we'd first planned on, and so I've broken this up into a part one and a part two. Please do feel free to check out part one first if you'd like to. Otherwise, you're very welcome to join us here. This is the second part, and I'm glad to welcome back Petya and Jörg. How do you personally make sense of it? And for someone who comes to you and says, hey, this is something I want to compare, do you have to match the technology with the downstream informatics side of it as well?
I think you do have to have the tailored downstream data analysis pipeline in place as well. It's because metabolites are inherently different from proteins and RNAs. You have to think about it as proteins and RNAs, they're all sequence-based. And so, and you can, well, more or less match the proteins and the RNAs to the genome sequence. And therefore, you have some common basis that you can work with. And we don't have that in for metabolites. So the first thing is that identification of the signals is a challenge, because particularly if we do something we call non-targeted metabolomics, where we want to measure with the least bias as possible, we measure the identity very indirectly. We measure chromatographic time, which is a measure, for example, for polarity, and we measure mass. And if your resolution is good enough, then from this mass, you can deduce a sum formula. But the identity of a metabolite is, of course, more than the sum of the atoms it is composed of, but how those atoms are connected. We don't have a direct measure of that. So identification is a huge challenge that other omics don't have. If you look then at the basic statistics, what we and others do, it's like you do the same dimensionality reduction, the same kind of heat maps. The statistics is not so different, but there are some steps which are special.
But what I would say is special and still a bit like, it makes me more and more curious. Like Jörg says, you measure a lot of signals in mass spec and you can annotate names of metabolites only to a fraction of them. And this fraction is actually smaller than people might think. I would say maybe 80% of the signals that we have, we don't really know what metabolite is behind them. And I'm always so curious, then you make your volcano plot and you see, oh, my most significantly regulated signals are not the ones that I can actually annotate to a name. So what are these? And I'm wondering, what do you think, Jörg? Are we going to get to a point where we can attach a name to most or all the signals that we get?
So with the technology as it is, unless there's like, you know, the very big throughput, that breakthrough that nobody has ever thought about before, I'm not sure. We, of course, can increase the number, but this comes at the cost of confidence. Instead of worrying about that there are so many signals which we don't know what it is, I think we should be happy for the ones which we can identify. And for the ones, even if we can't identify them, we can do something like a partial identification, something. We can say, okay, this is probably a very polar compound, or this is probably a completely apolar compound that's rather be located in a membrane, for example. And from that, you know, with this partial information, we can use all those even unidentified signals to do statistical analyses and separate groups. And so it's not that like they're useless. It's just not as nice to work with them.
So at risk of saying, and for those of us who remember Donald Rumsfeld, there are known knowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns. And I think that seems to be quite appropriate here in terms of the metabolites. One of the concepts you do describe, and you mentioned about sequencing, is that, you know, we've got layers. We've got genomic, transcriptomic, protein expression, metabolite abundance, and functional activity. So why do you think it is really important to try and integrate all of those together?
Maybe let me give here the example of acute myeloid leukemia, AML, which is also the disease we talk a lot about in our review, although similar concepts apply also to other diseases. So basically, originally what was defined as acute myeloid leukemia was a type of hematological cancer that looked at a specific way under the microscope. And as these technologies have been developed, we have come to understand that AML is actually a group of diseases with some very different genetic drivers and also with distinct biology and what matters for our patients with different therapy responses. So our current clinical considerations for treatment and risk stratification are based mostly on genomic profiling. But I think in terms of AML, and if we think about metabolism, genomics are probably just scratching the surface. So there was a study a couple of years ago from the group of Thomas Oetterich in Frankfurt, where they looked at primary AML samples and they did proteogenomics. So they actually also looked at the proteome. And what they found was that there are proteomic subtypes that were not reflected solely on the genomic characteristics. And remarkably for us, one subtype was the so-called mito-AML. So it was a cluster that showed high expression of mitochondrial proteins. And this mito-AML actually also had poor outcome. Now, this mito-AML cluster was not captured at the genomic level, which means that what we currently use for risk stratification, the genomic level, might not actually reflect the heterogeneity of the disease if we go at the protein level. And so I think that integrating all of these different layers in a meaningful way is a huge challenge, but it also might help us identify subtypes of disease that might benefit from a certain treatment that is not reflected just on the genomic or on the transcriptomic level.
The way I think is really, I want to know what the cell is doing about the function of the cell and how it will respond. And in that way, if you think about it, like all the cells in our body all have the same genomic DNA. So we will not find a difference between an AML cell and a healthy cell in the genome sequence because it's, well, by and large, it's the same. Experts might disagree, but by and large, it's the same. So the epigenetic landscape and expression of the RNAs are, of course, closer to what the cells actually do. But we know that there's still a lot of regulation going on when they produce the proteins. And then, of course, there's another level of regulation in post-translational modifications and metabolites, because they are, in a way, downstream of all those levels, because they are the reactants in the metabolic network. They reflect all those different levels of regulation and additionally also the environment that the cell sees. And so to get a complete picture, one really has to go through those layers and connect them and see how they interact.
One of the things is that when you have drugs, they actually target proteins, and we often stratify based on transcriptome and genome. So having a greater understanding on the proteome and the metabolome of where the drug targets are actually hitting, it obviously makes sense, especially for risk stratification. And one of the early concepts you describe in terms of the biology is this concept of metabolic plasticity. So maybe you can elaborate a bit more again on how this inherent flexibility of cells, particularly in the hematopoietic and immune cells, and how that plays a role in contributing not only to their normal processes, but how that actually changes in disease, particularly cancer.
Yeah, well, this I think is now the topic on which I could speak for the rest of the podcast. And there is just also so much evidence out there. So what kind of strikes me as a particularly important concept is that we think about metabolism and these biochemical reactions as something that kind of happens in the cells all the time because of their function. I think what is key to understand is that the proper metabolic processes or the acquisition of a certain metabolic phenotype is actually a prerequisite for the cell to fulfill its function. This is or became particularly evident in the field of immunometabolism, where it is now well known the cell needs to acquire certain metabolic changes to become an effector cell, and not vice versa. It is not that these metabolic processes are not just there by default. And so in terms of, if we stay with AML as an example, AML obviously arises from myeloid progenitor cells, but the metabolism of AML cells is very different from the metabolism of our healthy hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells. So healthy HSCs are relatively metabolically quiescent. And in AML, we have various metabolic alterations. There are many excellent reviews out there. Ours really also just scratches on the surface of this particular topic. There is evidence for an alteration in literally any pathway in AML. Some of them have emerged to be particularly important for AML biology. And I would claim that aberrant mitochondrial metabolism represents the best studied metabolic characteristic of AML. We understand that mitochondrial metabolism also ties it to this mito-AML cluster that I was talking about, that mitochondrial metabolism might also confer therapy resistance in AML. Also, interestingly, venetoclax, which is now has been such a big revolution in the field of AML in the last years, it targets BCL2, but by targeting BCL2, it also disrupts oxidative phosphorylation, so the mitochondrial metabolism of our cells. And so this is actually a drug, although its target, we might not think about it as a metabolic protein, but it actually causes causes cytotoxicity by disrupting metabolism. Yeah, and so I think there are many more examples also of alterations in lipid metabolism, such as ceramides, sphingolipids, are now a focus of studies in AML biology. Also, fatty acid desaturation is something that has emerged as important. There is a lot of evidence on different metabolic pathways. Overall, I believe, though, the big task and also challenge for our field is to identify aberrant metabolic pathways which are as much as possible specific to the cancer cell population and less important for healthy cells. We need to understand the cancer cell plasticity and to identify the key Achilles heels of cancer cells. But we also need to keep in mind, like you were saying, these metabolic processes, they are conserved throughout our body. And I think one particular challenge in translating the findings in the metabolism field to treatments is that the treatments would also target the metabolism of healthy cells, which gives a very narrow therapeutic window in the end.
Jörg, do you have any thoughts on the plasticity?
I think it's the way the plasticity can be challenging when I think about it is that we try to hit the cell like a malignant cell with a drug, but then the first thing we have to watch for is how will it escape. And because of this plasticity, there is a high chance of cells escaping our initial hit. And so I think this is just a reminder that we should think more about combinations of different drugs and combinational therapies to really nail down that thing. It's not like a point mutation where you can do target that one point mutation and this is the cause, but it's really it's a network, and networks just are inherently robust. That's how cells survive in different environments. But at the same time, you know, if there are cells that we don't want to survive, it makes targeting them a bit more challenging.
Yeah, this is an excellent point. There actually also is quite a bit of work from Craig Jordan's lab studying the resistance to venetoclax and how basically metabolic plasticity determines this resistance. And like we said, okay, venetoclax targets oxidative phosphorylation, but we now know that cells from resistant patients are actually able to engage other metabolic pathways. For example, they do a lot of fatty acid oxidation, or they have regulation of nicotinamide metabolism. And so there are really, these are examples of how we exactly try to hit one pathway, but the cells are flexible enough to engage other pathways and escape.
Absolutely. I think there's now a realization in the field when we look at, say, for example, diagnostic and relapse pairs, and the focus has been on what are the mutations which have been acquired over time, and very little knowledge has really come out of that in terms of how do we exploit that. And the non-genetic mechanisms during treatment, and then perhaps, as some papers have suggested, there's a stochastic acquisition or random acquisition of mutations which aren't actually the drivers of resistance. It was epigenetic or metabolic changes which were making these cells resistant, and then there's a secondary effect of the mutations, but it's that primary metabolic defect which is probably underlying that resistance. So it's a very good point to make.
I think this is also an example where it's nice to also look beyond your own field. And for example, there's quite a body of literature on decision making in bacteria, because in bacteria, I think you can kind of compare a population of AML cells to a population of bacteria living in a changing environment and having to respond. And then you will have some subpopulations which will be prepared for some event that the cells might experience in the future, and some others will not. So I think there's quite a few analogies that one might draw and then really learn from the findings in what seems like a very distant field, but you know, surprisingly often you can find some common ground there.
You don't have to remind me. If I just think about CRISPR-Cas, you know, CRISPR-Cas, where we would have been still using zinc fingers and talons if it wasn't for fundamental biology and bacterial and kind of like lower order organisms, which someone said, oh, hang on a minute, we can then repurpose that. So absolutely, I think it's a really important place that C. elegans, Drosophila, bacteria, yeast still has an important role in being able to understand fundamental mechanisms and that reductionist system, which we can then translate to more, you know, complicated ways. So great analogy. One of the useful parts of your review actually is that you've listed a whole list of techniques to study metabolism in terms of also saying where the sample is destroyed or not destroyed, which is also really great. And like most things, you mentioned there's spatial proteomics. You know, is that coming to metabolism, spatial metabolomics? Is that something on the horizon, or where are we sitting with that?
It's there. It's starting. Let's put it that way. It's starting. It's not established score. It's not so widely established yet. But it's like, so I'm personally absolutely convinced that spatial resolved omics technologies are the next best thing. So in my perception, those previously hyped single cell omics technologies, they're kind of plateauing in terms of new scientific insights. And it's this additional dimension that you see not only the cell, but the cell in its tissue context. And we know, we are quite aware that cell-cell surface communication is important, and you have gradients of nutrients across a tissue, and we know how nutrients are important and influence the cell. So we kind of always knew that there must be an influence. We just never had the tools to look at it. And now with the new spatial technologies, you can actually measure those differences that we always suspected to be there.
Well, the bad news for the hematology field is that I think spatial metabolomics from the bone marrow will remain a significant technological challenge for still some time, or at least this is what people who are experts in the spatial metabolomics field tell me, just because the bone marrow, because of the bone needs to be decalcified. So this particular type of sample needs to be processed in a very specific way that, from what I understand, still prohibits the use of this type of patient material for spatial metabolomics. And so I hope that we'll be able to overcome this challenge in the next years and to really see also the metabolite distribution in the bone marrow, which I think will be highly interesting also in understanding what comes from the niche, what kind of metabolic support do niche cells provide for healthy but also for malignant hematopoietic cells. I hope that we can get there. What seems to be possible though, and there is emerging data on the topic that I also saw at the EHA Congress this year in Milano, is spatial transcriptomics from bone marrow, where basically at least by the expression of metabolic genes, we can maybe start getting an idea about these processes.
Yeah, maybe there's some engineer out there listening to us, because I think the limitation is to cut the bone. So if we currently use cryomicrotomes to cut tissue slices, so if there's someone out there who has an idea how to build a cryomicrotome that can cut 10 micron sections, through solid bones, then, that might be the solution. And it's not a expertise that you find in a typical metabolomics or hematology lab. So it's, again, it's a question of bringing ideas together.
Indeed. Never say never. Never say never.
So one thing I wanted to add, why I think now is really the time to invest into that, that's why we also started looking into that, is because there's basically two rather recent technological developments that I think really made a difference. The one is that commercially available imaging mass spectrometry now got down to a pixel size of 5 microns. So finally, we're down to a pixel size which is smaller than the typical diameter of cells. So it gives the opportunity that you actually can get pixels that hit only a single cell and thus get like single cell information. The thing is, like, the smaller your pixel, the fewer ions, so the weaker the signals is that you get. And there's a second advancement, is that now secondary ionization is also available, which means you have you first generate ions from a pixel on your tissue slide, and then with UV laser or cold plasma, there's a second enhancement of that ionization, and that basically brings the signal intensity back to what it is for regular sized pixels without it. And so that really, the combination of those two and both becoming commercially available really has made a difference. I think that's why also at a recent conference where I was, you talk to people, you also talk to people at core facilities, more and more people are now acquiring the machines. They're still a bit expensive, but whoever can dig up the funding for it seems to be jumping into it.
Sorry, Petya.
No, I'm just looking forward to the first data set that we'll be able to acquire with our samples.
I think, and we're talking about spatial, I'm not even going to go there in this podcast, but maybe in the future we're talking about over time as well, the temporal ability to measure metabolites over time and in vivo and live, in terms of, imagine cutting a bone open and having some sort of intravital microscopy tag with metabolomics. And so you can see metabolic processes in real time, over time, when things are happening and change. I mean, again, if you're listening out there and you have ideas, I think you're at the very edge of the future, which is great. I'm going to go back to just a little bit still to go, but on a fundamental level, you've got this beautiful map behind you of where we're past Magellan's map of biochemistry in your poster, and we're going to be going, do we have to zoom into like a NASA type of
new world order of how metabolism works. But I'm just thinking of my own work and how we've been culturing cells in this really rich broth, right, of RPMI media that has excess glucose and amino acids because the challenge was to get these cells to grow. You know, from a fundamental level, you know, how has this really impacted our understanding of metabolism? Because we must have missed things for years and years in terms of cancer biology. And so I now know there's this push as well to go to this physiological media. So is this also at the very fundamental basic level something which we should be considering, even if we're not a metabolomics person and we just think actually we should be using more physiological conditions in general?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So I have to say when these media first came out a couple of years ago, or probably it's almost 10 years ago when they started being commercially available, I was quite excited. And I thought, oh, this is how we should be culturing ourselves in the future. My lab has not implemented this as a regular procedure yet, I have to say. There are notable differences between RPMI and what is currently described as human plasma-like media. There are, for example, one notable difference, which I think totally makes sense, is that in our serum, we have high levels of uric acid. This was not reflected in RPMI at all. Uric acid is a metabolism that has strong effects on pyrimidine synthesis or nucleotide biosynthesis. And so this is being a central metabolic process in the cells is something that probably has not been correctly reflected in RPMI so far. But then again, I have to say, we have now these media that are available that have plasma-like concentrations of certain metabolites. What we still don't know is what are the metabolite concentrations, let's say in our case, in the bone marrow and also in the diseased bone marrow. What are the actual metabolite concentration in the bone marrow of a patient with leukemia? How might these fluctuate also depending on the diet or on when the person last had certain food intake? Also, even when passing through the body in a seemingly homogeneous tissue like the blood, these conditions change a lot. And so blood cells, hematopoietic cells, malignant cells, immune cells, they constantly experience changes in these environmental conditions. I think this environmental heterogeneity remains hard to mimic, even with these new media. And I think this is where we also need our preclinical models on an organismal level where we can really reflect these things better. Or what do you think, York? Should you say, I need to culture myself in physiological media?
No, I think this is something like we touched upon earlier. It's a model system. It will generate some artifacts. And as long as you can get those artifacts reproducibly, you can still produce meaningful data. And so I don't want to throw all the research that has been done in RPMI in the bin. It's probably very highly valuable. You know, one just has to be aware that we cannot fully replicate the conditions in the body, let alone characterize them. Because, I mean, it's not just a composition of the medium. We know other things like dissolved gases, pH, temperature, also mechanical stress can have an impact on cells and on tissues. And so, and that's, you know, it's more than just the medium. So I think realistically, we just have to be aware that what we do in vitro will never be in vivo, and there's a place for both. And there's, yeah, but it might be one step for some. For some experiments, for some mechanisms that you investigate, when you see differences between in vivo and RPMI, it's probably worth a try to see if it might be the culture conditions, and other culture conditions will make a difference.
True. I think it always goes without saying that all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Correct.
Keep that in the back of your mind. Yeah. Okay, I'd like to wrap up in terms of just one last question. The future, clearly we're at the start of a very exciting period in metabolomics research because of these technological advances. And for the listeners, if you're interested in reading more, please go to the amazing review. Maybe you can sum up where you see the next five years or 10 years. Where are we heading in terms of metabolomic research? And Petya, maybe I can start with you.
Yeah, let me cover maybe more the clinical side of things, because being clinicians, I think we always go back to the point, okay, now we have more and more omics, we have more and more insights, we have, as I mentioned, basically any metabolic pathway is deregulated in AML. So how do we turn this into meaningful improvements for patient outcomes? I see two major challenges that our field needs to address. The first is, how do we implement all this knowledge into meaningful therapy decisions? I think that breaking, if we stay again with AML, making AML patients into more and more subgroups, I don't think this will really bring us to a big breakthrough, because then we get smaller and smaller patient populations for which it will get more and more difficult to design meaningful clinical trials. Then maybe we have let's say, this genetic mutation that is good risk, but this metabolic subtype that is bad risk. So what does this mean for the individual patient? I think here probably we need to pick one, two, three most promising metabolic changes, let's say, in AML cells, and really try to push them forward and to understand how can we implement this into our diagnostics. Does this help us identify patients who are genetically speaking, good risk, but actually because of metabolic characteristics, they are adverse risk. And do we want to treat these patients differently? So really to kind of build meaningful subgroups that we can also put into clinical trials and understand how we can make the outcome of these patients better. And then the second big challenge, and I pointed out to this already before, is how can we meaningfully target metabolism? We mentioned already the metabolic network is highly conserved across all cell types. And so when we target the metabolic pathway of cancer cells, there will very likely be also a healthy cell type affected by this intervention. And in fact, there was a clinical trial from our colleagues at MD Anderson Cancer Center just a couple of years ago. They had brought a highly potent and selective inhibitor for the mitochondrial complex 1 into a phase 1 clinical trial, both for AML and for patients with advanced solid tumors. And this compound had undergone thorough preclinical development. So what came out when the colleagues gave this compound to the patients is that unexpected toxicities emerged. It was mostly neurotoxicity and also elevated blood lactate. And so the trials had to be interrupted. This was, I think, pointed out again at we really need to try and identify metabolic vulnerabilities that are as specific as possible to the cancer cells. What I also dream about is a targeted approach where we will be able to deliver the metabolic inhibitors specifically to the cancer cells. We have these antibody drug conjugates with some cytotoxic drug. So can we maybe deliver a metabolic inhibitor specifically to our cancer cells? This is what I think we need to develop.
Excellent. Jörg.
I think it's my ideas are a bit along the similar lines, that is the context matters. You have to see the cell in its context. And of course, I come more from a like analytics point of view. And so spatial is really here to stay, and it's not here to replace any of the other omics technologies, but it really just gives us this additional level of insight. And it's not only spatial that you do now image tissue sections, but also that you worry about where in the body is the cell located, and the tissue context of immune cells or of cancer cells really, really matter. And I think also in metastasis research for solid tumors, there's like growing evidence of that. And there is more to take the context into consideration, and coming back to the spatial omics and metabolomics, and there's with the initial data that's out there, you find metabolites or lipids where we previously think they're doing pretty much the same thing. The one is just as good a membrane lipid as the other, but then we see that they're completely differently distributed across the tissue. So there must be some differences in terms of function or regulation. So it just opens so many more questions. As you mentioned, now we think we have a new technology, we can answer all those open questions, but it's just, again, we're just scratching on the surface. And of course, it's not only about generating the data, but then what you do with the data. It's at the moment, a lot of people can generate pretty pictures and they're impressive by themselves, but then the whole everything downstream has to follow that. How do you do calculate statistical significance for that? How do you normalize it across a patient cohort? It's all, so far unanswered questions as far as am I aware of.
From my perspective and an outsider, I can just imagine in 10 years' time, we've just seen the back of single cell atlases at the transcriptomic level. I'm thinking soon we'll have single cell metabolomic atlases of hematopoiesis and AML, et cetera, I can imagine as we get to that level and to give that greater level. Well, Petya, Jörg, this was a wonderful, wonderful discussion on metabolism or all things metabolomics. And I really encourage our listeners to navigate the Hemisphere, read the paper. It's wonderful. It's a tour de force on everything technological with some great examples on acute myeloid leukemia. And thank you both for joining us on this Hemisphere podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hemisphere podcast. All of Hemisphere's content is open access and can be found at www.hemispherejournal.com. We hope you will join us for future podcast episodes.